ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Humanities Research Institute. My name is David Shepherd. I'm Director of Research for Arts and Humanities here at Sheffield, a post that now carries with it the directorship of the Humanities Research Institute, or HRI. This is the second time that I've introduced an inaugural lecture since, by the initiative of my predecessor as HRI Director, Mark Greengrass, the Institute assumed responsibility for organising these important opportunities for recently appointed professors in arts and humanities to spell out their vision for the development of their subject and thereby bring the excellence of humanities research at Sheffield to the attention of a broad audience both within and beyond the university. On the first occasion, in November last year, I made the point that Professor Sarah Foote's lecture was therefore inaugural in two senses, inaugurating a new series and inaugurating her tenure of her chair. Now, I'm sure that best practice in rhetoric dictates that one should avoid repeating the same conceit, but perhaps I can be permitted a slight variation on it before I put it away conclusively. Today's lecture by Professor Martial Staub inaugurates as a venue for inaugural lectures these splendid new facilities of the Douglas Knoop Centre. The Douglas Knoop Centre is named at the request of the anonymous US benefactor whose generosity has made it possible to add to our Grade 2 listed late Georgian building, this imaginative green-roofed extension. It's named after the first professor of economics at the university, who took up his chair in 1920, in the days apparently before inaugural lectures had been instituted. I trust that habitual attenders of inaugurals at Sheffield will find these surroundings technically incomplete, as some of the wiring shows you, though they still are, but will find these more congenial than the Arts Tower's lecture theatres. Of course, one disadvantage that this room, large though it may be, has is that its capacity is somewhat more constrained than that of Lecture Theatre 4. That's why we were obliged to issue tickets on a first-come, first-served basis, and why, regrettably, although to the credit of our speaker this evening, many who wished to attend were disappointed and had to be turned away. However, as you'll see, the lecture is being audio recorded and will be made available for downloading from the HRI's website. We hope that this will help mitigate the disappointment of those who are unable to secure a ticket and also bring pleasure to those members of our speaker's family who have not been able to make the journey to Sheffield for this evening's lecture but will still be able to watch his performance at their leisure and perhaps even download the audio file to their iPods. But of course it will ensure that his lecture remains accessible to many other interested parties in the UK and around the world, thereby fulfilling a key aspect of the HRI's mission, the use of digital technologies, not as an end in itself, but to promote and enhance the understanding of the humanities by specialist and non-specialist audiences alike. And we're very grateful to the university's audiovisual services and to our own specialist staff in the HRI, Jamie McLaughlin and Ed McKenzie, for making it possible for us to do this. And we're also, of course, very grateful to Julie Bannum, the HRI secretary, and Beverly Eaton and her colleagues in history for carrying out the advanced planning of this evening's event with their characteristic efficiency. But to this evening's event. It might appear to somebody whose experience of inaugural lectures is confined to those hosted by the HRI that they are something delivered exclusively by professors of medieval history. I'm sure that our future programme, still in preparation, will prove that this is not the case. But in any event, as Sarah Foote's lecture demonstrated last November so admirably, it would be a mistake to assume, I think, that a focus on matters medieval is by definition a narrow focus. A focus that is exclusive of broad questions of historiography and theory that might more readily be associated by some with later periods of history. Like Sarah Foote's, Martial Staub's interests push at traditional demarcations, both chronological and disciplinary. Martial's research interest lies in the history of late medieval and Renaissance Europe, with an emphasis on local associations and communities, city-states, parishes, confraternities, guilds, and so on, and the participation of townspeople in political, religious, and economic life. His publications deal in particular with endowment practice as a form of participation in late medieval and Reformation Germany, as in his books The Parish and the City, published in 2003, and Endowing the Republic, forthcoming next year, 2007. His publications also reflect his interest in historical theory and historiography. So we have Presences of the Renaissance, 2004, and National Socialism in the Humanities, two volumes published in the same year, 2004. Now those last two titles demonstrate a scope extending beyond the medieval period as traditionally understood. And indeed, Marcel teaches with Mark Greengrass an MA module on religious pluralism and social integration in Europe between the 12th and the 18th centuries, thus crossing the major divide between the medieval and the early modern. He has also become increasingly interested, as many of us here will know, in the history of exile, working with colleagues in history and a range of other departments as well, including geography and Hispanic studies, to establish a major program of work in this area. And that's a program that the HRI very much looks forward to supporting. It's hardly surprising, in the light of all this, that Marcial is chair of the History Department's Research Committee, tasked, among other things, with preparing its submission for the 2008 Research Assessment Exercise and with setting its strategic direction in research. You may see those things as connected. You may say that that's entirely discreet. Not least among his many initiatives as a research leader is an exciting project to establish for Sheffield a European Graduate School for the Humanities. This will enhance the links between all arts and humanities departments and the European and Europe, building collaborations in postgraduate teaching and in research. Now, as someone who's worked in his time on the close reading of literary texts, I know just how dangerous it can be to seek to understand an individual's writings in terms of his or her biography. However, in Professor Staub's case, the life history does seem to provide some indication of the possible motivation behind his interests and achievements. He was educated at the École Normale Supérieure de Fontenay-Saint-Cloud and took degrees at the University of Paris and the University of Paris at Nanterre and at the École des Hautes Études en Sciences Sociales. He was a research fellow at the Max Planck Institute of History in Göttingen from 1993 to 2004, when we were fortunate enough to attract him here to Sheffield. Given that the questioning and transgression of boundaries, national, chronological, disciplinary, has been such a source of intellectual excitement, has been so important to Marcial's programme for taking his research forward, both before he came to this university and since he's been here, it's somewhat ironic that his purchase of a house in Sheffield should have been delayed for many months by such a commonplace feature of property transactions in this country as a dispute over a boundary wall. That dispute, I understand, has now been firmly resolved. And we trust, I'm sure, that along with his family, who are here this evening, and it's a delight to see them here, that along with his family, he feels as settled and at home here in Sheffield as is possible for a German-speaking scholar, born and educated in France, and about to deliver his inaugural lecture at a university in the UK on the subject of exiling history. Much love, Stan.
Thank you very much, David, for your very warm, welcoming words and for making it possible for us to meet this evening as friends in order for this inaugural lecture. I would also take the opportunity to thank the History Department, and particularly for Chumika, for all they have done too, in order to make this occasion possible, and I must confess that a lot has been on hold with regard to department business, but I assure you that I will start again working on all this issue tomorrow. Distinguished guests, dear friends, dear colleagues, ladies and gentlemen, it was not exile, not yet. Thomas Mann had been invited to the United States by the New York publisher Alfred R. Knopf. Knopf, or Knopf if you pronounce it in English, who had a good reputation in translating the work of great contemporary European literature, at that time neglected by American publishers, was keen to promote the first volume of Joseph and His Brothers, the first novel by Thomas Mann after he had been awarded the Nobel Prize for Literature. On the 19th of May 1934, Mann embarked at Boulogne-sur-Mer on the Dutch ocean liner Volendam for his third journey to America. 11 days later, on the 29th of May, he arrived at New York and would return to Europe on the 9th of June after a short stay. "Every return is transformation," writes Thomas Mann in the first volume of Joseph and His Brothers. "And just as the same number of colorful splinters keep falling into a never-changing display in a kaleidoscope, so life as it plays out constantly brings forth something new out of the same components, with the sun's constellation made up of the same fragments that had formed the constellation of his father's life." Europe had changed since these lines had been written. Mann faced a campaign in the media even before they were published. Eventually, Hitler had established his dictatorship in Germany. A return to Germany that Mann had left in 1933 was not conceivable unless the country changed. Personal identity had become a political issue. The question was no longer who Joseph was, but what Canaan was. Home. What does that mean anyhow? Does it mean Kusnacht, near Zurich, where I have lived for a year and I am more of a guest than at home? Does it mean further back, my house in Herzog Park, Munich, where I thought to end my days, and which has now revealed itself as nothing but a temporary refuge and pied-à-terre? Home, that must mean even further back, my childhood home, the paternal house at Lübeck, which still stands at present and yet is so deep sunk into the past. These reflections, written down by Mann on his journey to America, must have sounded surprising, to say the least, to the ears of the readers of the established Zurich newspaper, Neue Zürcher Zeitung, to which they were destined. Obviously, Mann did not really enjoy the ambivalent hospitality he had been offered in Switzerland. Yet the uncertainty expressed about tradition must have even more upset the conservative audience of the newspaper. Tradition, to which Mann's attitude was, yes, as he confessed, simultaneously loving and destructive, did no longer provide any comfort in his situation. Mann's insistence on the theme of the return is particularly intriguing in this context. For nearly 10 more years, Mann was to work on the adult Joseph until the fourth volume of the series was finally published in 1943, in U.S. exile. Attentive readers could, however, anticipate most of Mann's reflections from his reading during his first journey to America. Mann's account on this journey is called Voyage with Don Quixote. And in fact, his reflections were prompted both by the sea and his reading of Cervantes' Don Quixote, which he took with him in the famous German translation by Tieck. Mann refers at length to the second part of Don Quixote, and particularly to the complaint of Ricote the Moor. After Sancho Panza was forced to flee his governorship, he meets Ricote, a former neighbor, who was banished with other Christian Moor. Defying the exile sentence, Ricote returns to Spain among foreign pilgrims. Ricote exposes the motive behind his return. "Wherever we are, we weep for Spain. For after all, we were born there, and it is our natural fatherland. Nowhere do we find the reception our unhappy condition needs. And in Barbary and all the parts of Africa where we counted upon being received, secured, and welcomed, it is there they insult and ill-treat us most. We knew not our good fortune until we lost it. And such is the longing we almost all of us have to return to Spain, that most of those who, like myself, know the language, and there are many who do, come back to it and leave their wives and children forsaken yonder, so great is their love for it. And now I know by experience the meaning of the saying, sweet is the love of one's country." Records complain echoes Psalm 136. By the waters of Babylon, there we sat down and wept when we remembered Zion. Yet the country recalled and its fellow mortals remembered was the same country that exiled them. This contradiction could only be solved by interpreting exile as a sacrifice for the armed country. Cervantes introduced this move with deep irony. It was with just case, says Ricote the moral, that we were visited with the penalty of banishment. Ricote's complaint is not about the love of one's country. It is even not about the return to the armed country. It is not a complaint at all, but rather a hint at the politics of exile. Wherever exiles find themselves, whether they live abroad or they have returned to the homeland, they contribute an additional experience to the country in which they reside. Exiles are doubles. Doubles are all over the place in Cervantes' Don Quixote. The whole novel is actually built around doubles. Don Quixote and his faithful retainer Sancho Panza, or fantasy and reality, to mention but the most obvious. While rereading Don Quixote on his journey to America, Thomas Mann realized that exiles drew attention to the many ways to be present to the world, and that the sacrifice imposed upon them was not as much banishment as their having to forget who they were. Cervantes' ironic perspective had convinced him that tradition was an ars oblivionaris, a cultural technique of forgetting. In an article published a couple of decades ago under the witty title An Ars Oblivionaris, Forget It, Umberto Eco concluded that there was no ars oblivionaris, as there were artes memoriae, technique that is for remembering. Yet he hinted at strategies for producing oblivion. It is possible to forget on account not of defect, he wrote, but of excess, just as though it is not possible to destroy the meaning of an assertion pronounced aloud, it is possible to pronounce another assertion in the same moment, so that the two assertions are superimposed. Tradition is the violent superimposition of one assertion on another, which becomes exiled. Yet the voice of exile may resist the violence of tradition. As Thomas Mann would find out in the years ahead, Canaan was not origin. One of the many paradoxes of the Bible is that it is a non-starter. I do not mean that literally, of course. Yet the Bible would hardly have been the most influential book in history if it were one more myth of origins. The Bible is not a myth of origins, or at least it cannot be reduced to such a myth. This is, I'm afraid, what is usually overlooked by those people among our contemporaries who advocate creationism based on a literal reading of the Bible. In the beginning was Exodus. Yet Exodus was not the beginning. The second book of the Bible was fundamental in the genesis of the whole text. Biblical studies have certainly moved on since Julius Wellhausen, whose name I ought to mention coming from Göttingen, the place where he studied and taught until his death in 1918. As far as I can see, the great majority of Bible scholars rely upon Wellhausen's explanation for the origin of the five first books of the Bible and their complex narrative structure. According to the so-called documentary hypothesis developed by Wellhausen and his many followers, the Torah has got four different sources which were eventually redacted together into one final version. Whereas the outlines of Wellhausen's interpretation are still largely accepted, his insistence on monotheism being established as late as in the context of the Babylonian exile of the 6th century BC has been radically challenged. The emergence of monotheism is generally seen as a historical process which started in the Iron Age, centuries before the Babylonian exile. Narratives of impersonal processes of evolution were typical of 19th century theories of cultural development. These theories have largely been dismissed in the meantime, as they lost the significance of human experience. Morton Smith has shown that monotheism was already an established, albeit minority, position before the Babylonian exile. Its breakthrough in the 6th century, on the other hand, can only be explained by the challenge that the group identity of the Hebrews faced in the context of exile and the opportunity to rebuild identity that monotheism provided for a group in danger of losing its existence. Yet a single experience, be it as extreme as the Babylonian exile, could hardly have had such a fundamental impact as the construction of a religious and political identity that affected even the most removed areas of daily life, thus preventing the Hebrews from being absorbed by their wealthy neighbors. In the history of ancient Israel, exile was a returning pattern. The exile of 587 BC followed the destruction of the temple by the Babylonians. When the people of the south sat down by the waters of Babylon and wept, as the Psalmist said, less than 1.5 centuries had passed since the 10 tribes of the north had been scattered by the Assyrians. German Egyptologist and cultural theorist Jan Assmann has rightly emphasized how exceptional the experience of this group was, by antiquity standards at least, and how this repeated pattern of exile determined the written tradition of the Hebrews. According to him, the book Exodus became central to Hebraic identity precisely because it reflected on the singular experience of repeated exile. The Book of Names, as it is called in Hebrew, records the names of those who resisted both Pharaoh and the loss of collective memory after Jacob's sons had come to Egypt. Here God's name is revealed and Yahweh made a covenant with the Hebrews. The experience of this group was a singular one, as exile was a lasting threat. Unfortunately, Assmann, who has made a major contribution to broadening the scope of biblical studies by working out the Egyptian background of the history of ancient Israel, insists not only on the singularity of this experience, but also on the particular consequences the group drew from it. Assmann's attitude, paradoxically, conceals that the Old Testament is above all a meditation on heterogeneous identities, as the late Edward Said suggested in his 2001 lecture at London. Assmann and Said are both admirers of Sigmund Freud's Moses and Monotheism, to which Assmann has devoted a monograph. Yet to Assmann, the consequence of repeated exile was the canonization and hence historical relevance of what he has called the Mosaic distinction, the distinction that is between true God and false gods, and the subsequent separation of world and God, culture and religion, territory and covenant. In other words, ancient Israel's singular experience of repeated exile is deemed to have led to depoliticizing the world in a way unheard of. Assmann considers this radical step as a historical legacy of a monotheistic revolution, thus making Exodus a myth of origins, possibly the most extraordinary ever. Exodus is indeed an extraordinary story, but this is the case possibly because it is a political story. In fact, Exodus is one of the most political stories ever written. As Michael Walter has shown, Exodus is not a singular myth of origin, but rather a rejection of such myth in the name of politics. This also means that its unique influence is not the result of a kind of aggressive Sonderweg. but rather a reflection of the genuine universality of the questions raised in it. Exodus is not telling the story of the Hebrews' move, let alone return to Canaan. As Michael Walzer has remarked, the end of the story is nothing like its beginning, and yet it is present at the beginning as an aspiration, a hope, a promise. Accordingly, Exodus is about the march of the Hebrews to the Promised Land, and their march is full of difficulties, crises, and struggles, all realistically presented, as Walzer emphasizes. The purpose of the history is precisely to teach the importance of the march and the discipline necessary to its success. This history is political, not epic. To quote Walzer once again, it is about slavery and freedom, law and rebellion. Exodus is about politics in the making, about those repetitious murmurings against Moses and against Yahweh. The vox populi that Walzer listens to. Exodus politics continuously accommodates between what has been reached and what has been promised. Exodus recalls that it is better to be in Canaan than in Egypt, despite all those Canaans that have turned out to be almost barren. But what about those who have lost the hope on the journey and romanticized the wilderness or have even forgotten Egyptian slavery? To Michael Walzer, the latter are doomed to repeat the Exodus. The claim is typically expressed by an English fifth monarchy man writing in 1657 named John Cam. In the Lord's bringing Israel out of Egypt was shadowed out the deliverance of his church and people from all tyranny and oppression in the last days. The shadows are larger than life, Walzer elaborates on this passage. Not Egypt, but the world. Not this particular tyranny, but all tyranny and oppression. Not the future, but the last days. Please note the intriguing metaphor of the shadows, to which I shall get back later in my lecture. This politics out of disappointment is called messianic by Walzer, and he sees in it a tradition radically different from proper Exodus politics. Exodus politics reflects on the historical Exodus. Messianic politics prepares the second Exodus. Here Walzer is, however, trapped in the Sonderweg tradition. Not surprisingly, this attempt has attracted Edward Said's vigorous criticism. Walzer clearly constructs missionism so as to reintroduce the distinction between the world and God that Assmann has eventually coined as the Mosaic distinction. What Walzer describes is actually the misuse of Exodus by nationalism. For it is nationalism itself that made Exodus into a myth of origins. In a famous conference given in 1949, Ernst Kantowitz traced the early development of the idea of sacrifice for the own country, pro patria mori, within the political concept of the medieval Christian world. What he was particularly interested in was how dying for one's country was assimilated to Christian martyrdom. The crusade, it seemed, and the parallel drawn between Holy Land and Fatherland played an important role, particularly in the case of France. Yet, as Kantorowicz emphasized, the Kingdom of France was the land of the new chosen people. Interestingly, Kantorowicz also referred to the connotation of freedom suggested by the very name of the inhabitants of Francia as Francie, thus drawing attention to the political context. Medieval French authors were not only keen to use Exodus as a myth of origins. National mythology was deemed to embrace freedom. Did freedom represent a threat to the nation state? And did the importance of Exodus in national mythology also reflect such a threat? In any case, representations of exile are distinguished from the politics of exile. Exciting history is precisely about historicizing the representations of exile by rediscovering the politics of exile, as it is exemplary comprised in the book Exodus. Politicizing is not just demystifying, however. Representations of exile are not limited to national myths, but fundamentally shape the method and approaches of the humanities themselves. Again, Thomas Mann's voyage with Don Quixote is instructive. The essay ends with a dream. I feel dreamy from the early rising and strange experience of this hour. And I dreamed in the night too, in the unfamiliar silence of the engines. Now I try to recall the dream which assembled itself for my reading. I dreamed of Don Quixote. It was he himself, and I talked with him. How distant is reality when one encounters it from one's fancy? He looked different from the pictures. He had a thick, bushy moustache, a high, retreating forehead, and under the likewise bushy brows, almost blind eyes. He called himself not the king, the knight of Lyons, but Zarathustra. He was, now that I had him face to face, very tactful and courageous. Don Quixote is portrayed as Zarathustra. In the intriguing confusion between creator and creature, Zarathustra is depicted like Nietzsche himself. This is a tamed Nietzsche, however, as Thomas Mann insists, tactful and courageous. Thomas Mann's dream, indeed, can only be understood with reference to Nietzsche's Zarathustra. Read against this background, the whole essay appears to be a kind of anti-Zarathustra, and the main opposition between Mann and Nietzsche seems to reside precisely in their distinctive conceptions of exile. Mann's attack against Nietzsche might partly have been driven by Nietzsche's radical criticism of Christianity, in particular the analogy between Zarathustra and Christ, which Mann certainly found inappropriate, at least in the context of the 1930s. The divide was, however, deeper than that, and brought exile fundamentally into play. Zarathustra is in exile voluntarily. From the mountains where he has exiled himself, he teaches his disciples. His first speech tells a parable of the metamorphosis of the spirit. The camel represents reverence for the traditional values of his culture. Having heroically borne the burdens of these values, he speeds into the desert, where he anticipates being master of his own. There he realized, however, that he can only feel a master by defeating the traditional values with which he burdened himself. Thus, the camel transforms himself into a lion in order to conquer his freedom and be master in his own desert. The dragon, who represents all values, tells the lion that all value has long been created. Now the lion turns into a child to create new values suitable for his own life. Human values arise from the remnants of destroyed values. This is Zarathustra's teaching, and the very metaphor referred to in this context, in the context of this metamorphosis, is, interestingly enough, exile. Exile is used here in order to set up a myth of origin. In Ecce Homo, his most autobiographical book, Nietzsche explicitly makes this point. For the task of a revelation of all values, more capacities may have been needed than have ever dwelt together in a single individual. Above all, even contrary capacities that had to be kept from disturbing, destroying one another. An order of rank among these capacities, distance, the art of separating without setting against one another, etc. First come distance, exile, and then solitude. Nietzsche turns the Christian hierarchy between solitude and exile upside down. But this is not what Thomas Mann's criticism is about. On his journey to America, Mann was reflecting on the enlightening aspect of exile. He felt compelled to recognize and evaluate the foundation of his own culture. Yet this is precisely the reason why he rejected Zarathustra's heroism and Nietzsche's mythology of exile. Recent research has acknowledged that Nietzsche's project was in a sense mythological. Yet was this mythology romantic, as has been suggested? I doubt it. It seems to me that Nietzsche's perspective was rooted in a humanistic tradition. In other words, between man and Nietzsche, the humanist is not the one people may think. While during the winter months of 1883 and 1885, Nietzsche was writing Thus Spoke Zarathustra in the Provence, he was as close as possible to Petrarch. The Provence was the very place where the Italian humanist had challenged the Christian notion of solitude 5.5 centuries earlier in The Light of Solitude, and laid the foundation of the new role of the intellectual from the top of the Mont Ventoux. In his famous letter to Dionigi da Borgo San Sepolcro. The humanistic agenda was even broader than that, however. The first group ever, late medieval and Renaissance humanists, constructed a mythology of exile for scholarly purposes. Not surprisingly, therefore, Petrarch provides one of the first examples of Nietzschean exile, long before Nietzsche's death. Oh, happy those whom better days than ours have nourished. Would that I, but all in vain, my futile wish. It is impossible to turn back on our paths. My life is destined to be spent mid storms and turmoil. But if you, poem, as is my wish and ardent hope, shall live on after me, a more propitious age will come again. This Lycian stupor surely can't endure forever. Our posterity, perchance, when the shadows have lifted, may enjoy once more the radiance the ancients knew. The last verses of the epic poem Africa, written in 1338 or 1339, 2 years after Petrarch's epic ascent to the Mont Ventoux, confront us once again with shadows, the shadows of the Middle Ages. The shadows were dark, tenebrae, as was the continent that European seamen were starting to circumvent in these very years, and after which Petrarch's poem was named. Post-colonial historians have emphasized the humanists, and particularly Petrarch's, ties to European colonization, and the disturbing similarities between their approach to the past and the spatial articulation of power, which has been characteristic of European history from the late Middle Ages. Peruvian sociologist Aníbal Quijano has eventually theorized this perspective as coloniality of power. Yet, were the poem's shadows colonial shadows? In other words, did Petrarch claim that the immediate European past was closed in the same way as his contemporaries and fellow Italians were stopping the history of the natives on the recently discovered Canary Island? I don't think that the Middle Ages was born as exilic. Nor was Petrarch born in exile, as he claimed in his letter to posterity. As Nietzsche would recall centuries later while writing in the same place, Petrarch had chosen exile as a scholarly condition. From the mountains, where he had exiled himself on the pretext of new knowledge, his own time was no longer recognizable. Knowledge had become strange to life. Zarathustra would later proclaim on Nietzsche's behalf that life starts with a scholar's mythical exile. The rediscovery of the mythical moment of humanism was Nietzsche's, as Thomas Mann was aware. The great Renaissance scholar Jacob Burckhardt, a former colleague of Nietzsche at the University of Basel, had rather helped to conceal it. In a much quoted passage of The Civilization of the Renaissance in Italy, Burckhardt famously stated, "In the Middle Ages, both sides of human consciousness, that which was turned within and that which was turned without, lay dreaming or half awake beneath the common veil. The veil was woven of taste, illusion, and childish prepossessions, so which the world and history were seen clad in strange hues. Man was conscious of himself only as a member of a race, people, party, family, or corporation, only through some general category. In Italy, this veil first melted into air. An objective treatment and consideration of the state and all things of this world became possible. The subjective side, at the same time, asserted with corresponding emphasis. Man became a spiritual individual and recognized himself as such. Zarathustra reads in many respects like an inversion of his text, which was published 25 years earlier. The child is the Middle Ages that has been left behind. More importantly, Petrarch's shadow had become a veil that modern men have melted into air. Brokaw's version of the myth of origin of humanism is free from any connotation of exile. Yet, its very modernity becomes manifest in the mention of the state. Humanism is retrospectively legitimized as an essential contribution to the rise of the nation-state. And it is intriguing that the mention of exile had to disappear from the myth under those circumstances. Exile was apparently felt as too ambivalent a myth of origins of statehood in the context of 19th century German and possibly European nationalism and colonialism. As post-colonialism has it, physical and above all cultural exiles were being imposed upon people outside Europe as an essential part of colonial practice. However, projecting this practice back onto the Middle Ages and early modernity would be overestimating the power of the pre-modern state. Late medieval and Renaissance humanists deplored the lack of statehood as deeply as Nietzsche felt in Sperling. Both the humanist and Nietzsche acknowledged that politics existed beyond the boundaries of the nation-state. Yet, one of the main characteristics of humanism was that it remained focused on the nation-state. For this very reason, Thomas Mann rejected the humanist mythology of exile that he had just rediscovered on his journey to America. It's not a provocation, but yes, it is. Thomas Mann had worked for quite a few years on Joseph and his brothers when he went from Swiss exile to America in 1934 in order to promote the first volume of his book. Right against this background, the political dimension of Mann's essay on his journey becomes apparent. Recent scholarship on Joseph and his brothers has stressed the importance of Freud's reception to Mann's work and how his interpretation of Freud both affirmed and superseded psychoanalysis drama of development. Whereas late Freud had become increasingly interested in cultural development and the origins of religion, Mann was fascinated by the younger Freud and personal identity. To some extent, however, he shared the concerns of the late Freud, yet he was able to make them more explicit. Psychoanalysis is a manifestation of modern irrationalism that unambiguously resists reactionary misuse, wrote Mann in 1929. In other words, reflections on personal identity could not and should not by any means be separated from reflections on political identities. In the meantime, Mann had become an exile and was discovering Exodus politics while crossing the ocean. Exodus politics is genuinely civic. Thomas Mann was familiar with civic tradition from his youth at Lübeck, where he was brought up as a son of a town senator and merchant. In the Buddenbrooks, the partly autobiographical story of the family of Lübeck's oligarchy, for which he was awarded the Nobel Prize in Literature in 1929, he had partly anticipated the end of this tradition in Germany. Lübeck had been for centuries the head of the Hanseatic League, a federation of cities whose civic history easily compares with other parts of Europe, including the Italian city-states. The Italian city-states were the background against which Petrarch and his fellow humanists dreamt of a nation-state. Medievalist and Renaissance historians were long trapped in Burckhardt's modern myth of origins, despite their different perspectives. Eventually, historiography has specifically reassessed the importance of the city-state in late medieval and Renaissance Italy and Europe. However, humanistic mythology has hardly been worked out, let alone in terms of the political context in which it was developed. I have hinted at how Petrarch set up a myth of origins based on exile, and how important exile epic was to late medieval nationalism. Yet it would be too simplistic to view a direct relationship between both mythologies. This would possibly also conceive the intriguing interaction between a humanistic mythology of exile, on the one hand, and exodus polity, as it shaped Italian politics in the late Middle Ages and the Renaissance, on the other. Historians who have assessed rather positively the role of the Italian city-state have nonetheless usually been struggling with what may be called hierarchy of sovereignty. Northern and central Italian cities, it has been claimed, faced a major political challenge in the 14th and 15th centuries, as imperial authority had failed. In fact, as an English historian recently noted, there is no legislation from the 14th century emperors concerning Italian cities. There is, however, a mass of papal legislation. Yet papal claim to overlordship was not a serious problem in theory, although papacy would eventually rise to a major regional agent. The rise of civic sovereignty in the late Middle Ages has generally been viewed as a consequence of the decay of imperial authority and the problems which arose in the process of civic affirmation as the price to be paid for replacing the collapsed order. Civil law seems to provide strong evidence on this, although it first and foremost was imperial law, as has rightly been emphasized. Yet, from a second look at such evidences, it appears that 14th and 15th century civil law was very much preoccupied with the relationship between cities and the definition of the space between cities, or, to use another metaphor, the property of global commons. Interestingly enough, these issues had not been set on the agenda by the emperor. They were not even of legal origin, but rather originated in the regional political context. All over the places in civic Italy, contending factions continued to call themselves Guelphs and Ghibellines, thus recalling the past days of the rivalry between the Pope and the Emperor. No longer, however, had these powers the ability to mobilize the political agents for their cause. In a situation very similar to ancient Greece, late medieval and Renaissance cities struggled with majority vote. This procedure required that the minority accepts to be defeated. That seems to be obvious to us, but it's not. Yet medieval canon had popularized the maxim, quod omnes tangit, ab omnibus approbari debet. What touches all must be approved by all. Literally interpreted, this meant that all the members of a corporation had the right to consent to the act of the corporate body. Where majority vote and quod omnes were competing norms, the consequence of disagreement was exile. Italians did not leave things half finished, however. Unlike classical Athens, the minority faction was usually exiled as a whole, and not just its leader, or as it attends, its second leader. Exile was massive in the world of the Italian city-state, and it was common. This had all sorts of destabilizing effects on the cities where exiles lived, on the relationship between the cities in which the exiles lived and those which had expelled them, and on exiling cities themselves. Exile factions could, and often did, claim to be the true representatives of the city and to act on behalf of the whole body politic. These were pressing practical issues, alongside many others, and they awaited novel political answers. In the very case of exile, the answer was juridical, and the innovation consisted in part in inventing a legal framework between the city-states. Exodus politics was not limited to reflections on exile practice, however. For sure, exile was massive and common in late medieval and Renaissance Italy. Yet, the very originality and open-mindedness with which this phenomenon was politically dealt gives us a hint at how settled Exodus politics was in this very context. The civic dimension of the Italian Renaissance has been worked out by German Jewish scholar Hans Baran. He famously tied it to what he called civic humanism. According to Baran, civic engagement rested on the moral emphasis on active life and the very assumption that virtue must be constantly tested and practiced. This moral project was humanistic in that it was connected with a new type of historical thinking, which rejected supernatural justification for hierarchical government and was open to various kinds of states, particularly the city-state. Historians have, however, hardly noticed how deeply Baran's perspective changed after his exile, first from late Germany and later from fascist Italy. During and after the war, Baran had already settled in the US after a brief English episode, he was to pay particular attention to what he would eventually call in his major book, published in 1955, The Crisis of the Early Italian Renaissance. There, Baran presented civic humanism as a reaction, a reflection on the threat to Florentine liberty at the beginning of the 15th century. The Duke of Milan, Gian Galeazzo Visconti, had served as a catalyst for Florentine civic culture exactly as Napoleon and Hitler would later do in the English case. This is explicit in the book. Baran was no longer talking about civic humanism, although he kept using it. His topic had become republicanism, as you may call it. He was interested in political institutions rather than in intellectual history. In fact, his interpretation reads very much like an adaptation of Toynbee's model to political history. Arno J. Toynbee started working on his major work, A Study of History, in 1934. To Toynbee, civilizations were born as a response to challenges, and they developed in different ways depending on their approach to the challenge they faced. The rise of civilizations was driven by creative minorities, which were eventually imitated by the majority. More recently, German historian Reinhard Koselleck formulated a model which was in many respects comparable to Toynbee. However, his emphasis is clearly on war. According to Koselleck, defeat prompts a productive process of reflection. Florence had already been defeated militarily when Gian Galeazzo Visconti died from plague shortly before entering the city in September 1402. And this certainly proved a traumatic experience to Florentine republicans. Yet it seems difficult to endorse Baran's Miracle of Dunkirk thesis to explain the rise of Florentine republicanism, and only few historians did. There can be no doubt, however, that a decisive shift in values can be dated to a single period and described as a result of that period's dominant experiences. The question is whether Gian Galeazzo's 1402 campaign was such an experience. Implicitly, at least, Toynbee, the late Baran, and Koselleck all value singular events as the ultimate factors of historical change. The most important factor in the history of the late medieval and Renaissance city-state was, however, people's participation to political life. Michael Walzer's sympathetic lines on the people's stiff-neckedness also applied to the Italian context. Exodus politics rests on people's realism. This is not only the case because some among the people are tough-minded and skeptical realists asking hard questions. The people also make for realism because the path of the march must be set with their feelings in mind, because their rebellions must be dealt with. Leaders chosen from the midst and the law expounded in the hearing. Exodus politics is genuine republicanism. Recent scholarship has paid particular attention to the diversity of republican thought in history and challenged the thesis of the continuity of classical republicanism after the Renaissance, particularly in the Atlantic context. Republicanism, it seems, can no longer be considered as a continuous and uniform discourse, as assumed by John Pocock in the Machiavellian moment. Yet was discursive practice even an essential factor of the history of republicanism? What it is possible to do in politics is generally limited by what it is possible to legitimize, would answer Quentin Skinner on behalf of the so-called Cambridge School of Intellectual History. For sure, societies talk to themselves, and intellectual history not only relates to what used to be called real history, but it is an essential part of it. Politics is, however, more open than Pocock and Skinner seem to admit. At least, it can be more. People's realism is an important part of real life. Exodus politics is about people's realism and the openness of politics. That is why it also leads out of Cambridge. Come to the last part. Thomas Mann's dream with Don Quixote and Zarathustra, of which I spoke earlier, was a prelude to his arrival at New York, which Mann described as a vision. Out of the morning mist slowly emerged the skyscrapers of Manhattan, a fantastic landscape group, a towered city of giants. This was not a new world. There was no new world. Mann realized that the Atlantic Ocean connected rather than separated Europe and America. Yet this journey was not a migration from the original to the copy, the ancient to the modern, tradition to innovation. As Mann anticipated, the sea proved a decisive experience. On board, the sea was all over the place, and so was the world. Similarly, fantasy and reality are indistinguishable in Don Quixote, this ocean of a book, as Mann intriguingly described it. The conclusion was that there is only one world, and that this world is like dream. There is no shadow, only life. With the strongest light, Kafka writes in Aphorism number 54, with the strongest light, one can dissolve the world. Before weak eyes, it gains in solidity. Before weaker ones, it develops fists. Before even weaker ones, it becomes bashful and crushes him who dares to look at us. Exile is the strongest possible light, and Exodus, a world in which life is greater than shadows. This greater world, however, is not a foreign land, as there is no outside. There are no third place and no separate past either. Since for exile, the world is unique, and all people, present and past, real and imagined, dwell in it. This is why literature is about the world, and this is why history is to be exiled. Historians cannot resuscitate the past, but attempts to represent the past are no less illusory. History is genuinely investigation of the reality of the one world. These are the researches of Herodotus of Halicarnassus, were possibly the first words ever written by a historian. As Herodotus made it immediately clear, the authority of the historian's account rests on his name. The historian is the author of his text, contrary to a bard with the interpreter of the news. Herodotus did not give up the scope of the epic, however. The all-embracing vision of the news was still his ideal. According to his own account, Herodotus' intention was, quote, to go forward with his account and speak of small and great cities alike. For many states, he adds, that were once great had now become small. The historian's ideal of omnivision is politically justified, as it appears. Political life is not confined to great cities. Many small cities were once great, and some of the great cities of the day may lose influence in the future. Influence is changing, yet the precise nature of the cities is not affected by change. Cities remain cities, regardless of their importance or lack of importance in the present. This conclusion is crucial for historical investigation, for the diversity of the city would hardly be an intellectual issue if powerful and less powerful cities could not by any means be compared to each other. The question we find at the origin of Herodotus' investigations is, why is it that some cities are great and others small, although they all have a political life? It is the answer to this very question that eventually led him to reconsider politics, convinced, quote, that human happiness never continues long in a state. Not only the cultural, religious, economic, social and political frameworks matter, but also the alternative options people are able to work out, the decisions they make, and the ways decisions are enforced. In this sense, historicizing is, properly speaking, politicizing. Exiling history does not mean that historians should exile themselves from history, as humanists did. It is, to the contrary, an anti-humanistic purpose, a project bar of any mythology. The most achieved example of anti-mythological history that springs to my mind is Ernst Kantorowicz's great book on the King's Two Bodies. This certainly is a surprising choice, even if not for the reason people may assume. The King's Two Bodies is a political book, yet it is political in the widest sense. It reflects on politics in the making, on Exodus politics, as did those 14th century Italian civil law specialists that I have mentioned and that Kantorowicz so deeply admired, and as did Dante, whom he admired even more. Dante had accompanied Kantorowicz since the days of his biography of Emperor Frederick II. The picture Kantorowicz drew of the 13th century Hohenstaufen emperor in this first major book of him explicitly aimed at creating the myth of a national leader in the context of Weimar Germany. This is why Kantorowicz consciously avoided a footnote apparatus in the first edition from 1927. Dante's authority backed this vision that was inspired by another poet, Stefan George, whose nationalist circle Kantorowicz entered in 1920. Dante only proclaims what Frederick II had lived, wrote Kantorowicz at the end of his book. The King's Two Bodies was published exactly 30 years after Frederick II, in 1957. Eventually, Ernst Kantorowicz, a Jewish scholar, had left Germany and had lived in exile in the US for nearly 20 years. Kantorowicz was indebted to anti-democratic and nationalist values, which were radically challenged by his exile experience. Things were different in Hans Baron's case, for instance. Yet the fact that Baron had been a Democrat before he went into exile did not prevent him from mystifying the origins of Italian republicanism. And his interest in republicanism did not exclude some fascination for American nationalism. To the contrary, Baron's humanistic perspective favored certain confusion between republicanism and nationalism, as we have seen. Kantorowicz had been a humanist in the extreme Nietzschean sense. In his second exile at Princeton, however, he came in many respects close to Thomas Mann. Princeton was also the second station of Thomas Mann's exile. In 1938, he accepted an appointment as visiting professor at Princeton and left Switzerland for New Jersey before moving to California in 1940. In 1949, Mann finally returned to Switzerland, alarmed by attempts to control and repress the activities of intellectual and leftist group. McCarthyism, that these activities were to be called, is also the very reason why Kantorowicz left California, where he had first emigrated, for Princeton in 1950. At Princeton, Kantorowicz politically followed in Thomas Mann's steps. With Cervantes' assistance, Mann had learned to reject myths of origins. Kantorowicz's teacher was to be, once again, Dante. Dante, like contemporary 14th century civil law specialist, yearned for the presence of the emperor in Italy. Yet he too was aware that the imperial power was no longer an important political factor. Dante's most paradoxical book in this respect is his treatise on monarchy from 1313, to which the final chapter of the King's Two Bodies is devoted. Dante's monarchy apparently develops the vision of a universal monarch. The third book is particularly important in this respect, as it deals with the relationship between the emperor and the pope. Dante's aim, it seems, was to prove that his universal monarch was free from papal jurisdiction. This meant that he had to build up a whole sector of the world which was independent not only of the pope, but also of the church, and virtually even of the Christian religion. This is, as Kantorowicz suggests, a possible interpretation of the theme of the terrestrial paradise in Dante's monarchy. Such an interpretation came close to the picture that Kantorowicz had himself drawn of Dante in his biography of Frederick II. Yet Kantorowicz, the exile, did no longer believe in it, and the King's Two Bodies hints at another Dante. The monarchy was the work of a republican. As Kantorowicz meticulously worked out, this is not the vision of a world designed to be ruled by the emperor for the sake of eternal peace. Peace to Dante was both fruit and condition of political negotiations among citizens. Confronted with the major political challenge of his time that had forced him into exile a decade earlier, Dante made the case for people's individualism, individual freedom, and political responsibility. At the opposite end, the younger Petrarch, whose parents had been exiled from Florence with Dante in 1302, thought with refuge in mythology. Like Hans Baron's Crisis of the Italian Renaissance, that had been published 2 years earlier with the same publisher, Princeton University Press, The King's Two Bodies was centered on the Renaissance, against the background of what Kantorowicz called medieval political theology. However, both books could hardly have been more different. Dante had learned Kantorowicz to side with Exodus politics and to be suspicious of myths of origin. Yet Kantorowicz's republicanism was even more far-reaching than that. Modern myths were fundamentally national. The nationalism Kantorowicz had adhered to as a young scholar was not a German exception, even if German nationalism eventually caused far more suffering than any other nationalism ever. Myths of origins were the nation-state's response to the challenge of Exodus, as Kantorowicz now knew. The purpose of such myths was to root tradition, as was the concept of continuity to which the King's Two Bodies was devoted. Thus, interrogations like those that occurred to Mann on his sea journey with Don Quixote could be avoided. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you very much, Marcel, for a wonderfully wide-ranging and inspiring lecture. You will recall that one of the traditions associated with inaugural lectures is that we do not subject the lecturer to a grilling afterwards. There will therefore not be questions. However, there will be ample opportunity to speak to Marcel, I hope, informally, if you'd like to join him over a glass of wine or a drink, a refreshing drink, which will be served just through the double doors there afterwards. So thank you all very much for coming, and please do enjoy the rest of the evening. Thank you.